Later that night, I was up in my room. I watched as the small and community bloomed. So simple yet so complex, I contemplated my own life and wondered what would come next. I took out my favorite aunt and crushed it with my dick. And also, I fucked my aunt. Damn, I fucked my aunt. And I fucked my aunt. Man, we fucked our aunts.
Hello and welcome to the podcast that has spent years trapped in the quantum realm, Film Bookcast, the official podcast of filmbook.com. My name is Mike Smith. Joining me, as always, is the world's greatest grandma,
Mike DiCrescio.
How are you doing today, Mike?
I'm just very proud of all my grandchildren.
That's good. That's good. Would you like to knit me a sweater at some point?
I mean, don't push it, man.
Okay. Fair enough. I'm not one of the grandchildren. I don't know why I asked. Also joining us is a guy who we've mentioned on this show a lot. He is sort of our producer in a spiritual sense. He'll check the minutes for the podcast when we finish recording. Colin Stiles, welcome to the Film Bookcast for the first time.
Thanks, guys. Long time, first time.
Yes. Yeah, this will be cool. You've been like a recurring joke on the podcast for a very long time. Not a joke. You're not a joke, Colin.
We value as a person,
exactly,
we swear.
Exactly. But it has become a running joke where we're like, oh, Colin will check the minutes on the podcast. Because you were like the first listener of Film Bookcast, really.
I'm pretty sure I've listened to more episodes of Film Bookcast than anybody else.
Probably more than I have, honestly. So, yeah. Yeah, you're probably right. So, that's very exciting.
Comes on the show, dunks on us.
Now, if you're not like Colin and you've never listened to Film Bookcast before, first we start with some film news and then move on into some discussions where Mike and I each discuss whatever piece of media we've been consuming lately. And then after that, we move on into our featured review. This week, we are discussing the latest film from director Peyton Reed and the 20th film in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, Ant-Man and the Wasp. Is it weird that this is the 20th film in the Marvel Universe and not Avengers Infinity War, which is like the big one?
Yeah, and Infinity War will be the 22nd movie.
Yeah, 22nd. So, because Captain Marvel will be 21.
Yeah.
So Infinity War 2 will be 22. Yeah. So it like missed out on like a couple of the big numbers there, man.
Yeah. But you know, it makes sense that the biggest, you know, the big number is the littlest movie.
That's true. That was very inspiring, Mike. Anyway, before we get into all that Ant-Man stuff, we got to talk about some film news. So it's time for film news here on Film Bookcast, and we've got a few things to get through today, and I wanted to start off with the thing that is probably most exciting to me, and to probably at least a few people out there. Mike, as you're well aware, Colin, I don't know if you're a fan of this franchise or not, they're making a new spinoff of the Fast and Furious movies, starring The Rock and Jason Statham, two of the best parts of those movies. It's being directed by David Leitch, the co-director of John Wick and director of Deadpool 2. And now there has been a villain cast for Hobbs and Shaw, the spinoff, and it's pretty amazing. It's a pretty amazing casting choice. Idris Elba has been cast as the villain of Hobbs and Shaw. So in my eyes, this is already the greatest movie ever made. And I'm curious what you guys think.
I can't wait to have Idris Elba and Jason Statham just have like a Cockney off.
Right?
They're awesome accents.
While The Rock is just flexing in the background.
Yeah, just doing the, like, peck dance thing that he can do. Just for 2.5 hours.
Exactly.
I would pay to see that movie.
Yeah, right? That just seems like such a good idea. Like, that 2 hours of that, I'm down. Are you a fan of the Fast and Furious movies?
Not a huge fan. I think the last one I saw was Tokyo Drift.
Oh, man.
Oh, my God.
You're missing the best ones.
You gotta slog through the first four.
I was not a fan, so I was like, I'm just off this.
Yeah, that's fair.
That's fair, but
I mean, for listening to you guys, you both love the new one, so maybe I am missing out on something.
Yeah, no, I mean, if you get through the first four, because I think the first one's okay.
It's a big ask.
I know it's a big ask. It's only 8 hours of your life. You can get through it. You get through the first one, which I think is okay. And then Too Fast is not very good. Tokyo Drift has some cool races, but is ultimately not very good. Fast and Furious, the fourth one, that's probably my least favorite. It's very bad. But then you get to Fast Five. And it takes all the elements from the bad ones and brings them together to make something amazing.
It Avengered before the Avengers.
It really did. I mean, it's like successor to Ocean's 11 in a weird way, too. It's super crazy. And then it just kind of went nuts from there. Like, these movies have gotten increasingly bonkers over the last few years, to the point where, you know, the last one featured them in the Arctic fighting a gigantic submarine, and The Rock, like, moved a torpedo with his hands, and it was great. It was awesome. So anyway, The Rock has been one of the best parts of this franchise since Fast Five, and Jason Statham has also been a highlight since Furious 7, and so now teaming these two characters together, that's awesome. David Leitch directing, even more awesome. Chris Morgan's writing, who wrote most of the Fast and Furious movies, although he's not writing Fast and Furious 9, interestingly enough. That came out recently, too, because he's focusing on this movie. So all the energy is really going towards this, because I feel like most people don't want to work with Vin Diesel anymore, and I feel like that's part of why they're making this movie.
I mean, if you're going to have a big action movie and it's going to have Jason Statham and The Rock, which one are you going to bet on?
Exactly. Like, this is going to be huge. I am very excited about this, and just Idris Elba as the villain is just icing on the cake, because he's had, like, a lot of blockbuster roles in the past, but I feel like he's not usually that well serviced by them. Like, he was good in Pacific Rim. That was a great role for him. But, you know, with, like, Prometheus and, like, the Thor movies and Dark Tower and stuff, I always feel like whenever Idris Elba is in a blockbuster movie, it's just not very good. You know? Like, he's always wasted in the role, or, like, the movie itself isn't that good, and so... like, that was my biggest complaint about the Thor movies, honestly, is that Idris Elba is in, like, 5 minutes of them total. Like, he's just there, and not doing anything. And so to have him as the villain, pretty cool. But anyway, let's move on from that into some other casting news that I'm less excited about. Even though I am a big fan of Spider-Man, you know, I love Spider-Man, and Sony is trying to get a lot of these Spider-Man spin-offs off the ground. And I am not really on board with most of them. I think we talked about Silk last week, or last episode, and how that could be a cool movie if that actually comes to pass. But it seems like one of these other ones is coming together a lot more quickly, and that is Morbius, the Living Vampire. So sure, like, why not?
It's no Black Cat, Silver Sable.
Yeah. That movie, that is totally happening, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Morbius Living Vampire, we talked about a little while back when they announced the movie. Now it has a director and a star. The director is Daniel Espinosa, who made Life, which we all know was the prequel to Venom. and the star is Jared Leto. Jared Leto has been cast as Morbius the Living Vampire, because he's got such a great track record with comic book characters, you know?
Yeah, I mean, sure. This is a great way to guarantee this movie does not get made.
I mean, it could get made. I think this movie will get made if Venom does really well.
Yeah, that's fair.
Now, do you expect Venom to do very well?
Not even close.
See, I don't know. I feel like Venom's a popular enough character where it might do pretty well at the box office. Also, somebody, like, put an article out recently. There was somebody tallied up the YouTube trailer views for Venom compared to the other Spider-Man movies. And the Venom trailer has been viewed more times than any of the Spider-Man trailers, which part of that is because I think YouTube exists post Spider-Man 2.
Right.
So
yeah.
Like, the first two Spider-Mans don't really count in that, because who's going to go back and watch the trailer when it's not coming out? But even, like, it's ahead of the Amazing Spider-Man movies, it's ahead of Spider-Man Homecoming, and so that's kind of, like, that's an interesting barometer. I don't know how that'll translate to box office, but, you know, it's something.
But how many of those views were people just trying to get the clip to make the GIF of Venom with googly eyes?
Also,
that's
a very good point. Yes. Or most of those could just be people who wanted to fuck Venom, because that's a thing on the internet that
yeah,
that exists.
It's Rule 34, baby.
Yeah. But anyway, yeah. So Jared Leto as Morbius, though. Like, do you think this is a good casting choice? Do you think Jared Leto is an actor who can pull off a living vampire type role?
As someone who has no idea about Morbius the Living Vampire in the slightest.
Right.
Sure. I would be okay if we just, like, didn't with Jared Leto anymore as, like, an entity.
Right, that's also fair. I think I've been pretty open about not being the biggest fan of Jared Leto. I think when we talked about him in Blade Runner 2049, I think I called that movie so good that even Jared Leto can't ruin it.
Can't quote yourself.
I'll check the minutes, but I'm pretty sure he said that.
Thank you, Colin. This is why you're on the podcast. So, yeah, I mean, like, I would kind of be down for a Morbius movie, I guess, but at the same time, it's just like, you know, if you're going to make these Spider-Man villain spinoffs without Spider-Man, like, I just don't see the point of that. you know? So, I mean, we'll see how it goes with Venom. I don't think it looks very good. But, like, if it is, then maybe Morbius will happen. Otherwise, maybe that Black Cat Silver Sable movie can happen. Like, who knows? Who knows?
Anything's possible.
Anything's possible. But let's move on from that into some non-superhero news. Why not? Did either of you guys see Lady Bird by any chance yet?
Yes.
You did.
I did not.
Mike,
no.
You did not. Man, come on. You got to go see Lady Bird.
Look, okay. Both of you are Mr. Movie Pass, I think.
No, I don't have Movie Pass. I just got really bored. Well, I rented it on Amazon.
All right. You got to poke holes in my defense, so it's fine.
Greta Gerwig released a movie last year called Lady Bird. It was very big. It was nominated for a bunch of Oscars and stuff like that. And now Greta Gerwig has lined up her next project, which is an adaptation of Little Women, which is kind of a surprise. It seemed like she was going for... more original stuff. In the Lady Bird interview, she was saying she wanted to do like sort of a whole Southern California cinematic universe in a weird way. But it seems like she's doing Little Women, but more like an updated kind of modern day version of Little Women. And a pretty amazing cast has already been lined up, including Meryl Streep, Emma Stone, and Saoirse Ronan and Timothée Chalamet, who are in Lady Bird. So I don't have any familiarity with Little Women. Like, at all. I know there were several movies that were made out of that book. One of them had Winona Ryder in it. I'm curious if you guys are familiar with it at all. Mike, you were an English major, so, like, you might...
So here's the thing. I have no idea about this. One of the things I saw when this was announced was everyone like, oh, great, another Little Women adaptation. Like, oh, whatever, we don't need this again. But then I also... You know, like 20 minutes later, after everyone on Twitter rage tweets, they're like, oh, but wait a second. And they were like, okay, this cast with Greta Gerwig as director seems really cool.
Right.
So, like, I guess I'm going to follow groupthink and say this seems cool, but I don't really know anything about it. So,
all right, cool. So none of us know anything about Little Women, is what it sounds like. This is why we need to get a female voice in the podcast, I think.
Yes.
That's what it sounds like.
We're lining one up. Don't worry.
Yeah, great, great. But anyway, yeah. So I've never read the book Little Women. I've never seen any of the movies. But a new Greta Gerwig project is always very exciting to me. And the fact that she has moved into directing is pretty cool. I mean, she's been making some great movies for a very long time, especially her stuff with Noah Baumbach. Mistress America, I've talked about on this podcast before. I think one of the best movies of the last several years. It's so funny and so good. So people should check that out if they haven't. But anyway, and also check out Lady Bird, Mike. What's wrong with you? Get on that.
It's just like so much time in the day.
It only takes like an hour and 40 minutes to watch Lady Bird is all I'm saying.
Okay, fine.
Just get on it, man. That's all I'm saying. But anyway, we got to go ahead and move on from that and move on into some Lucasfilm news because a few things have come up in the world of Lucasfilm. Indiana Jones 5 is a movie that is still happening. And Spielberg is still directing it. Harrison Ford is still attached to star. And now we know that Jonathan Kasdan is currently writing a new draft of the script. David Koepp was writing the first draft, and he was the co-writer of several films. Spider-Man, I think he co-wrote Jurassic Park. He also co-wrote Mission Impossible, the original. He also had a hand in writing Indiana Jones 4, Kingdom of Crystal Skull. John Kasdan, son of Lawrence Kasdan, has written for a few things in the past, wrote for Freaks and Geeks, the TV show, but more as a more high-profile gig, he co-wrote Solo, a Star Wars story, with his father, Lawrence Kasdan. And now he is currently writing the new draft of Indiana Jones 5. So I think it's an interesting hiring choice, especially because Solo kind of underperformed and people kind of derided it for its screenplay. Ourselves included in that.
Yeah.
But I think Jonathan Kasdan is a talented writer in other things. So I think Solo is just kind of a little bit of a fluke. I think there was a lot of stuff that they wanted to work into Solo and just didn't pan out or didn't get played as maybe it should have. So Jonathan Kasdan writing Indiana Jones 5, not the worst news in the world. I think it's interesting that he did Solo and now he's moving on to a movie that actually has Harrison Ford in it. But also, Indiana Jones 5 has been delayed again. It's likely going to come out in 2021, when Harrison Ford will be 78 years old. And that's insane to me. That's like, I just don't understand. I want to see this movie because it's a new Spielberg movie. And also because I like Indiana Jones 4. I'm the guy who likes Indiana Jones 4. But even then, like, Harrison Ford was, what, in his mid-60s when that movie came out? And it's like... Like, he was already getting too old to be Indiana Jones.
One of the whole plot points of that movie was that he's going to hand it off to a younger version of himself.
Right. That was the whole thing. Like, they were going to hand it off to Shia LaBeouf, which is such a mid-2000s thing to say.
Yeah. Oh, shit.
But, yeah. So, are you guys on board with Indiana Jones 5 at this point with a old ass Harrison Ford playing Indy, which will probably take place, I think, in the 60s or 70s. I think it would have to take place like years. I think the 60s is what they've said.
As much as I'd love to see Indy get his whip caught in a wheelchair, like.
A half hour just spent trying to untangle his whip from the wheel.
I hated Indiana Jones 4. Like, I kind of want to forget it happened and just have 3 Indiana Jones movies.
I mean, if this is... Oh, go ahead.
No, what were you going to say, Mike?
If this is some kind of, like, Bubba Hotep situation, but with Indiana Jones, I'm on board.
Yeah, I just had the vision of, like, can you imagine if, like, Sam Raimi directed Indiana Jones 5 with, like... old Harrison Ford, that would be pretty wild. I mean, I'm on board with Spielberg. I love Spielberg to death, as you well know. But just Sam Raimi going nuts with Indiana Jones with like elderly Harrison Ford, like I'm down. That would be incredible.
Fighting Nazi Bruce Campbell.
Oh my God, that would be dope.
Here's my other pitch for Indiana Jones 5.
Go for it.
We have some kind of Captain America situation where Indiana Jones is frozen so that he can wake up in modern times and just be as old as he would be normally, and he fights like modern day neo-Nazi people. That's it.
Okay,
that's the whole movie.
That's a good idea. I think what they should do is they should use the de-aging tech that Marvel has been pioneering with their Marvel movies. You know, how they have like young, like in Ant-Man and the Wasp, they have like young Michelle Pfeiffer and young Michael Douglas popping in for like a few minutes, and it's like, holy shit, how are they doing that? They should just do that for the whole movie.
Just young Harrison Ford.
Yeah, make it like 30-year-old Harrison Ford, have it take place in the 30s, have him fight Nazis, and it's... That's your movie right there. Or, failing that, he, like, hands off the franchise to Alton Ehrenreich at the end, of the movie.
Oh my God. They're gonna pull a Grand Moff Tarkin, but with River Phoenix.
Oh, man, that would be...
That was dirty. Yeah, it happened. That was dark. Took a dark turn.
Yeah, but no, you're right. That could be a thing that happens. But anyway, speaking of very old actors who were in Star Wars movies, some pretty major Star Wars news came out yesterday. Mike, you hadn't heard about this, and I was kind of shocked about it because I feel like a lot of people were talking about it. It kind of got buried throughout some of the other news throughout the day. But in terms of the film news, this was pretty big. Billy Dee Williams, who played Lando Calrissian in Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi, will be returning as Lando in Star Wars Episode 9. And I'm curious what you guys think about this, because I have a lot of mixed feelings. Colin, why don't you go first?
I love it. I love Lando. I love the original Star Wars movies, so just more Billy Dee as Lando is only a good thing for me.
Okay, yeah, fair enough. Mike?
Yeah, I think so. I think I'm down for this, but as much as I keep saying every time we talk about a Star Wars movie, I want other shit. I mean, it's cool. Like, it makes sense because it is Episode 9 and it's not a spinoff. Like, it's not, you know, it's not one of those Star Wars stories.
Right.
So, I mean, sure. Why not, I guess? We're out of other characters, so
well, that's
Lando's up next.
That's the thing. Okay, I love Billy Dee Williams. I love Lando. He will be 81 when this movie comes out. And part of me doesn't want an 81-year-old Lando in that movie. I want to preserve the image of Lando in Amber, you know what I mean? Like, he's just like that smooth ladies man in that weird corner of the galaxy. I kind of just want that. But at the same time, I feel like bringing back Lando is such an Abrams move. Like, it's such a J.J. Abrams thing to do. Yeah. I feel like he's a filmmaker that traffics heavily in nostalgia. That was an issue that I had with Force Awakens, where it's just, you know, I think Force Awakens has a lot going for it, but at the same time, it does feel like it dips its toe into the nostalgia well a lot. And I think part of that was just the nature of it being like the first Star Wars movie with the original cast in a very long time. But I think bringing Lando back now in Star Wars Episode 9 feels like a weird move. Like, if you were gonna bring him back, I think Episode 7 or 8 would have been the time to do it, you know. And I know when they were making The Last Jedi, there was a very early draft of Rian Johnson's script where the codebreaker they were going to meet on Canto Bite was going to be Lando.
That would have been so awesome.
He ended up tossing that idea and replacing him with Benicio del Toro's character. But, you know, that was kind of the idea originally. And now, like, if you've waited this long to reintroduce Lando, I just feel like it's weird because it's like, you know, you killed off Han and you killed off Luke. And obviously Carrie Fisher is not going to be in Episode 9. Leia's not coming back. So, like, the only character who has, like, any connection to Lando is, like, Chewbacca. And...
yeah.
Like, everyone else is going to be like, who's this old guy that's... that's fighting with the Resistance now or something. And, like, you know, where The Last Jedi ends, like, maybe there's a reason that they find Lando. Like, you know, the Resistance is down to, like, 10 people. Like, they all fit in one spaceship, so it's like they need to reach out to, you know, past allies. And, like, sure, bring Lando on board. But I don't know. I have very mixed feelings about it. At the same time, it's Billy Dee Williams' Lando. So there's that.
Yeah, I feel like there's also potential that it might just be a cameo. I mean, I don't know if we have more details in the news story or anything.
Well, I don't know if they would announce it this far ahead in advance if it was just like a quick cameo. I think they would.
Okay,
fair. They would want it to be like a surprise, right?
Yeah, that's a good point. So never mind.
So I don't know. I mean, I think I'm still very excited for episode 9. I want to see the conclusion of this trilogy. But at the same time, I feel like, you know, I'm going to miss Rian Johnson, is all I'm saying. Anyway, so I think that about wraps up our film news discussion. Guys, let's move on into our discussions.
Watch this. These are my discussions. Just when I thought I said all I could say, my buddy and I talk about movies we see. These are my discussions. There is so much to see, you and me. So we're going to talk about movies for our discussions.
All right, it's time for our discussions here on Film Bookcast. Colin, since you're the guest, why don't you start today? What do you got to discuss?
Awesome. I got a Tag to discuss, a new comedy directed by Jeff Tomczyk, starring Jeremy Renner, Ed Helms, Jake Johnson, John Hamm, Hannibal Buress, and Isla Fisher. I'm not normally a person who likes to pay money to go see comedies in theaters. I'm normally a waste of my money, but I just come with coworkers wanted to go see it, and it was actually hilarious. It had this weird action. They turned Tag into like an action movie that, like, at times where you have this like insane, like a great cast of just one action star, Jeremy Renner, and just a bunch of my favorite comedians, like Ed Helms, and they just this wild ride across the country of this group of friends who've been playing Tag their entire lives, and it's Ed Helms' character wants one last go before one of them retires. Which is the undefeated character played by Jeremy Renner, whose name I forget. His character, Jerry Pierce. So, yeah, I mean, it was just an overall really good time. It had one of the more uncomfortable punchlines. I don't really want to spoil it. If either of you guys want to plan on seeing it.
I wanted to see Tag. I haven't gotten around to it.
Yeah, would definitely recommend it. But one of the last punchlines of the movie is incredibly uncomfortable. Very funny, but also just like it kind of makes you sit there and go, did they actually just make that joke?
Okay, cool, interesting. I'm intrigued for sure. Now, did Jeremy Renner's CGI arms distract you at any point in the movie? Because I mean, we mentioned this before, you didn't know that his arms were CGI.
No, not at all.
Right? So for some background, in case anybody doesn't know, Jeremy Renner injured both of his arms on the set of Tag. He broke both of them. And which is awesome because, you know, he's an Avenger, he's been in Mission Impossible, he's been in Bourne movies, never had an onset injury, and now he broke both of his arms playing Tag. anyway, so they put his arms in like green, like sleeve casts, and they CGI'd his arms into the movie. So I think like 90% of the movie is like CGI arm Jeremy Renner. But it sounds
that's the best thing ever.
It's such dedication. I love it.
Yeah. But it sounds like it's a seamless effect. Like you didn't notice it.
No, not at all.
At all. That's good.
I mean, to be fair, he doesn't have to do a lot of tagging because he's never it. So you're more focused. You're not really focused on his arms.
Interesting. So he injured himself without even tagging anybody.
Yeah. No. He's undefeated in tag. So, you know.
Wow.
It would have been amazing if he just like had C-3PO arms the whole movie. Like, just in his casts, and then never explained why.
He's never commented on.
No.
Cool. So that is Tag. It's in theaters right now, and I do want to go see that. I think it looked pretty funny.
Definitely do.
Yeah. All right, Mike, what do you got to discuss today?
Today I have two movies, the first of which is The Void from 2016, directed by Jeremy Gillespie. And this is a Netflix original, I think also partly crowdfunded, or something along those lines. I was looking on the Wikipedia. There was some like weird thing about it.
Yeah.
And this is a horror science fiction movie that basically it features, I don't remember the actress's name, but she was Knives in Scott Pilgrim vs. the World.
That's Ellen Wong.
Ellen Wong, yeah. She's in it, which is cool. But basically this is a local sheriff while driving on the road, sees like an injured guy and like throws him in the back of his car, drives him to the hospital, and, like, literally all hell breaks loose. Okay. It's got like a bit of Event Horizon vibes going on. It's just like insane, creepy horror science fiction shit starts happening, yeah. and just these people trapped in a small town hospital, trying to survive what's going on. And it's fun. Like, it looks beautiful. I should have looked at who the cinematographer was, because, like, it's awesome. Like, there's such beautiful shots. There's some really cool effect with the, like, portal thing that's happening that goes on. And one of my favorite parts is it's all practical effects, 100%.
Ooh, nice.
Like, goopy, like, wet, gross, gore shit happening. And it's awesome. Like, definitely taking cues from The Thing and just weird eldritch horror shit going on. So definitely, and it's an hour and a half or whatever, and it's a cool science fiction horror movie.
Cool.
And then my second movie I want to talk about is Murder Party from 2007, which is Jeremy Saulnier's directorial debut.
Okay.
Friend of the show.
Yeah, Jeremy Saulnier. So director of Blue Ruin and Green Room.
Which are two movies I love.
Yes.
And I remember seeing that he had directed this movie called Murder Party, and I was like, where am I going to find that? One, and two, I need to see it. And then it's on Shudder. It's available on Shudder to stream. And this is a weird fucking movie, especially compared to Blue Ruin and Green Room, which are like really intense melodrama, like
they're pretty ultra-violent. I would go into the realm of ultra-violent.
They are ultra-violent, but to me, when I say ultra-violent, I think of like stylized violence, like in Kingsman. And
interesting,
this is like hyper-realistic violence, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know how to describe Jeremy Saulnier's brand of gore.
Okay.
But Murder Party, as the name might suggest, is a horror comedy in which this like lonely, nerdy, you know, horror movie geek on Halloween. It starts with him buying horror movies on VHS and going home to watch them with his cat, Sir Lancelot. And he finds an invitation to a spooky murder party in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. And he decides to go. And it turns out it's actually people trying to murder somebody, and he happened to find it in their invitation, and they just try to murder him. And it's weird. It's like a criticism of art critique, like, as an entity, and my man Macon Blair's in it, which is always great.
Sure.
Our boy. So I'm not even really sure how I feel about it. It is funny. It doesn't... It's sort of... You just spoofs horror tropes and stuff like that, so it's more of just a comedy that happens to be about murder. But it's cool. It's cool. It's Jeremy Saulnier doing his thing. So people should check it out if you can get your hands on it.
Cool. And that's available on Shudder. And The Void is on Netflix, right? That's where that
yes.
is?
Yes.
Cool.
Correct.
Yeah. And actually, it's interesting you brought up Event Horizon when you're talking about The Void. Because I just watched Event Horizon like 2 weeks ago. And
I love that movie.
I wasn't gonna bring it up in discussions, but since you brought it up, it's what a fucking movie, man. What a film! Capital
Was
F.
that your first time seeing it?
No, I had seen it very drunkenly one night. I think I was like my freshman year of college. I was in a mood where it was like 8 o'clock at night. I knew I had to go to bed at like 9:30, and I was like, all right, I was gonna watch something like that's relatively short and really stupid. And then I put on Amazon Prime, and the first thing I saw was Event Horizon. I was like, done. So that's what I did, and man, I mean, just Sam Neill is so crazy that, like, so good.
You ever wanted to see Sam Neill pull his own eyes out?
Right.
Watch Event Horizon.
That line he has towards the end, where he says, "Where we're going, we don't need eyes to see." It's one of the best lines in cinema history. Just straight up, it's so good. But anyway, that's Event Horizon. Watch it. It's on Amazon Prime. Go watch it. But the actual movies I wanted to talk about today, I did the weirdest double feature of all time this past weekend. I did a double feature of Won't You Be My Neighbor and The First Purge.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So I started off with Won't You Be My Neighbor. So I went in with this very nice movie, and then I ended with a very bleak movie. But anyway, this is the new documentary directed by Morgan Neville, who directed 20 Feet from Stardom a couple years ago. And this is a documentary about Mr. Rogers. And I think... I have seen so many reactions to this movie online. People like have talked about how much they've been like sobbing throughout the movie and how they love it and it's very powerful and emotional and stuff like that. I would say I think your mileage might vary depending on how much you watched Mr. Rogers as a kid.
Because, that makes sense.
because I definitely remember Mr. Rogers. Like, he was like, I was a presence. I think his show ended in like 2001, something like that. But I feel like I don't have the attachment to it that a lot of other people do. So I thought this movie was very nice. It was very well put together. And I think it offers a pretty cursory view of his life and work. But I personally thought it like rushed through a lot of the most interesting stuff. Like there's a segment in here early on in the movie about how PBS was fighting for funding from Congress early on in their career, like in the early 60s, and if they didn't get it, they would be shut down forever. And like Mr. Rogers has to testify in front of Congress to a senator, and it's really captivating and really cool, and it's like 5 minutes long, and it could have been a whole movie. Like that could have been an entire movie about just that struggle, and I would have been like really into that. But you know, you get like the entire Mr. Rogers' life and work and stuff like that, and there's some interesting stuff going on, some funny interviews and stuff like that. I did discover that I do have a lot more affection for the Eddie Murphy SNL parody of Mr. Rogers.
Oh no!
Mr. Robinson's Neighborhood, which I don't know if have you seen Mr. Robinson's Neighborhood? Really? Okay, it's one of my favorite SNL sketches probably ever. And they showed a clip of it in the documentary, and I was like, oh yeah, Mr. Robinson's Neighborhood, this is great. And I want a documentary about that. That was, but it's a parody where Eddie Murphy plays like a Mr. Rogers type character, but he lives in the slums. And so he's like talking about like how he's going to kill his landlord and like, somebody will knock on the door and it'll just be like, it's like, we'll go see who at the door, kids. And then he turns around, like, who is it? And that kind of thing. Super funny. Go check out some Mr. Robinson's Neighborhood if you haven't seen those. It's really funny. But anyway, yeah, Once Upon a Neighbor. I think if you love Mr. Rogers, this is a documentary for you, basically. And there's a lot of interesting stuff in here and a lot of fun stuff, too. And then I followed that up with The First Purge. So the complete opposite movie to that. But as you know, Mike, I unironically love the Purge franchise. Just straight up.
I am aware. Yeah.
I think these movies are fucking wild. I love them. This one is directed by Gerard McMurray. This is the first one not directed by James DeMonaco, who has created this franchise from the beginning. He does write the screenplay for this one, though, so his voice is still there. But this is a prequel showing how The Purge began. So in the original Purge from 2013, that's like the 10th Purge that has happened. So The Purge has been going on for a while up at that point, and Purge 2 and 3, same deal. So this one is the very first one where it starts off as an experiment taking place on Staten Island before it goes nationwide. Because, of course, it's Staten Island.
That's so perfect.
And I thought this one was fine. It was, you know, totally acceptable. Like, I got my Purge action, and that was cool. This one draws on blaxploitation elements, which I thought was kind of cool. That was kind of an interesting take on it. There's one character named Skeletor, who is terrific. It's this guy, Rotimi Paul, who's the actor, giving a fucking wild performance. He's not in the movie enough. Like, he's in maybe, like, the first half hour, he's in a decent amount, but then he kind of disappears for a long time. Then he shows up at the end, and it's great. But this is, like, if he was in more of the movie, this could be, like, on par with, like, a Nicolas Cage performance kind of thing. Like, that's...
Wow.
Like, he's going full ham on this. Otherwise, like, it's relatively standard Purge stuff. It's a group of people that are trying not to get purged. Well, other people are trying to purge them, and it's, you know, that kind of thing. But what I love about this franchise is that, you know, it's gone really heavy into the social satire aspects of it. And I don't think it was as on point this time around as it has been in the past few. I mean, in the last one, I think it never really got more on point than it did in Purge 3, which is Purge Election Year, which was about, you know, sort of an election that came out, like, 6 months before the actual election. And it had, like, stand-ins for Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, and one of them was pro-purge, and one of them was anti-purge, so you can guess which one was which. You know, it's a very blunt social satire that they've got going on, but I think it's a really effective and very angry social satire, and I'm really into that. Also, Marissa Tomei is in this movie. And, you know, I guarantee you she spent, like, one day on set, the amount of time, like, the way she's used in this movie. Most of her scenes are in one location. There's one bit towards the beginning with her character standing next to another character, and it's very green-screened. It's very distracting.
Oh, no.
For the most part, I think if you like the Purge movies like I do, this is a fine entry. It's not as good as, I think, any of the three. Have you seen any of the Purge movies, Mike? I'm just curious.
No, it's been one of those franchises I've seen and admired for their, like, social satire and commentary, and I've wanted to watch them.
Yeah.
I just never did, like Lady Bird.
The poster for this movie was a red hat that said The First Purge on it. Like,
yeah, no, like, that was the thing where I saw that. It was like, I gotta see these movies. Yeah. Like, I gotta do it.
Colin, have you watched any of The Purges?
No. They're on my list of ones I want to see, but I have not had a chance to see them yet.
Yeah, fair enough. I think most people don't like the first Purge, the original Purge, because this one's the first Purge now. Stupid. But most people don't like the original Purge in 2013. I do. I actually saw that movie twice in theaters. The reason I think I've told this on the podcast is I took two different girls to go see the Purge.
You fucking scumbag.
Well, I mean, that was a situation where, like, I had broken up with one girl and then another girl came along while the Purge was still in theaters. So
fair.
But anyway, then about a year later, then the Purge 2 came out and I didn't go see it in theaters. Cause I was like, well, it doesn't have any of the cast of the original Purge. I'm not sure if I'm interested in this. Then I caught it on TV like a few months after and I was like, holy shit. Cause Purge 2 is amazing. Purge 2 is so good. Frank Grillo is in Purge 2 and Purge 3 and he anchors those movies. He's so good. And Purge Election Year is also pretty solid too. And then this one, it's fine. It does the job. It does the Purge things pretty well. Also, there's a Purge TV show coming out. I don't know if you guys know about this.
What?
This movie ends with a mid-credits scene that is a teaser for the 10-episode TV series that will air on USA later this year.
What a twist.
Yeah.
Who knew the Purgeverse was so strong?
Right? So I'll be watching that. and I'll give you my reports on whatever this Purge TV show ends up being. But anyway, I think that about wraps up our discussions. Let's move on into our featured review of Ant-Man and the Wasp.
Dr. Pym, I actually heard what happened to you. You opened up the quantum realm. That's when this crazy creepy ghost who, like, walks through walls and stuff. Stole your tech. And now she wants to take over the world or whatever. Who would have believed that in your hour of need, you would turn to us?
Not me.
Because we robbed you. Do you remember? That's us.
The only chance you've got is both of you.
Ant-Man and the Wasp teaming up.
Follow my lead.
She seems more intense.
All right, that was from the trailer for Ant-Man and the Wasp, the new movie written by Chris McKenna, Eric Summers, Paul Rudd, Andrew Bearer, and Gabriel Ferrari, and directed by Peyton Reed. It stars Paul Rudd, Evangeline Lilly, Michael Pena, Walton Goggins, Bobby Cannavale, Judy Greer, Tip T.I. Harris, David Desmalchin, Hannah John Kamen, Abby Ryder Fortson, Randall Park, Michelle Pfeiffer, Lawrence Fishburne, and Michael Douglas, among others. And the IMDb plot synopsis for Ant-Man and the Wasp reads, as Scott Lang balances being both a superhero and a father, Hope Van Dyne and Dr. Hank Pym present an urgent new mission that finds the Ant-Man fighting alongside the Wasp to uncover secrets from their past. So before we get into our thoughts on Ant-Man and the Wasp, let's talk about Ant-Man. And I guess, obviously, Mike, you and I are pretty well established as pretty big fans of the Marvel Cinematic Universe as a whole. Colin, you've never been on the podcast before, so are you a fan of the Marvel Universe? I'm assuming you are because you requested to be on this episode.
Yes, love the Marvel Universe.
Okay, cool. So you've seen all the movies, all 20 of them, and you have like thoughts about each one kind of thing?
I have not seen Black Panther. It's the only one I have seen.
That's kind of a major one, dude.
Yeah.
Son, I am disappointed.
Yeah, that's a major one, but it doesn't really relate to this movie at all, so I guess you're fine. But you should probably watch Black Panther. It's on Blu-ray right now. You should,
Yeah, I gotta go to Target later, buy some for the apartment. I'll probably buy it.
Yeah, there you go. Now, Mike, you're also a huge fan of Ant-Man, the original Ant-Man movie, right?
Oh, man, that feels like a lot of pressure to live up to, but yes, I like the original Ant-Man.
Well, I'm just going to say, I think you've said in the past, Ant-Man is your favorite Marvel movie.
Oh, man. Have I? I mean, I have said...
Colin, can you check the minutes on that?
Check the minutes, Colin.
I got you. He's definitely said that.
Okay, that's fair. So, I mean, I am a big fan of that movie, apparently.
I mean, do you still hold it as your favorite Marvel movie, or do you think it ranks elsewhere now?
I think it has been dethroned. Okay. I think maybe Thor Ragnarok might be number one now.
That's fair.
And I was thinking about that, honestly, while, like, watching this movie and thinking and you know, digesting Ant-Man and the Wasp was, I don't think I've seen the OG Ant-Man in a while.
Right.
So I think it might have fallen down a couple slots.
Okay, interesting. I like the first Ant-Man. I tend to think of it as kind of an uneven movie. I think it's one of the weaker Marvel movies. I think it's pretty uneven in the first half before it hits its stride in the second half, and then it's a lot of fun. But I think it's a little uneven at first. Colin, what's your take on the original Ant-Man? What was your reaction to that movie? I'm assuming you've seen that one, right?
Yes.
Okay.
I've seen the first Ant-Man. I just wanted to see this without having seen it, so I had no idea what was happening.
Ant-Man, Wasp, who are these people?
Who are these guys?
It was weird. Then he got, I had no idea what was happening the entire time.
This is the weirdest Incredibles movie of all time.
But in all seriousness, I really like the first Ant-Man movie. And I like the just change of scope from like this big like intergalactic, you know, crazy battle that all the other ones are, to just like this like super personal, just like small scale thing. It's kind of refreshing.
Right.
In a sense.
Yeah, definitely. And both Ant-Mans came out right after like big Avengers movies too. The first Ant-Man came out right after Age of Ultron, and this one's coming out 2 months after Infinity War. So they kind of serve the same purpose with like a nice little like fun, family-friendly palate cleanser of a movie.
You did text me exactly that. Yeah, it's like the sorbet of Marvel movies.
The sorbet. Mike, let's start with you. What are your overall thoughts on Ant-Man and the Wasp?
I had a lot of fun with Ant-Man and the Wasp. It does a lot of the stuff that I enjoyed from the first one. It's so funny to say, like, it's a small-scale movie. It's a movie about ants. but it is that. It's disconnected from a lot of the other stuff that's going on, and it's fun. It's Paul Rudd is just like, what a hunk, you know? he's always hilarious. And I was distracted. I mean, I don't know how... It's not spoilery, I don't think. Well, maybe. I was distracted by stuff that wasn't involved in this movie, I guess.
Okay, so I think I know what you're saying. I don't think it's a spoiler to say this movie, I think, takes place before Infinity War.
Right. Yeah, it does.
So it kind of deals with the aftermath of Civil War in a big way, but I think it takes place mm-hmm. like, slightly before Infinity War. I think that's what you're saying, because you're trying to figure out where it's taking place in relation to what's happening in Infinity War.
Yeah, and I was, the whole time, I was just thinking about, like, but in Infinity War stuff. And we're like, we gotta go get this thing. And it's like we're doing our fun Jolly Ant-Man adventure. And I liked that adventure. I liked what was going on. I think Ghost is a really cool villain. There's great character work with Lawrence Fishburne and Michael Douglas and Michelle Pfeiffer. Everything is, it's good. I like this movie. But there's so much hanging over it. external baggage.
Sure.
That like sort of distracted me from the movie I was watching, because all I was thinking about was Infinity War.
Yeah, I can see what you're saying. Now, Colin, what are your overall thoughts? What was your take on Ant-Man and the Wasp?
Yeah, I also had a lot of fun watching it. It was cool to see the, you know, the kind of the repercussions that, you know, fell upon Ant-Man after, you know, prior events. You know,
right.
So you know, just seeing, you know, how his aftermath, and also seeing like his relationship like with his daughter like continue to grow was like a lot of fun to watch, because I thought she was hilarious. Like every time she was on screen, she cracked me up. Yeah, just had a lot of fun again. I like just this smaller, just let's see these little personal, you know. I mostly like the villain was not like a bad person per se. Like she was just trying to fix her own life. So it was cool to see like the outcome of this was more or less the outcome for one person on the galaxy.
Yes, and I did like that a lot. I feel like the only people who are affected by if the heroes don't accomplish their goal, the only people who are affected by it are the heroes themselves and no one else. And
yeah,
I kind of like that about it. You know, especially like compared to like Black Panther and Infinity War, this is like a Marvel movie that just feels like a loose hangout comedy, for like long stretches. And it's a very like family friendly. It's just a nice movie, and I really enjoyed watching like that niceness of it. I feel like I got more out of the niceness of this than I did watching My Neighbor, in a weird way. But I also feel like this one feels like a lot more consistent than the first movie for me, and it sort of serves the same purpose, like a palate cleanser after that big Fate of the World team-up movie, because at this point, almost every Marvel movie has, like, these galaxy-spanning stakes, and it's kind of nice to just have, like, these, like, small, like, this small little corner of the Marvel Universe. Even with Spider-Man Homecoming, right, like, you had, like, Spider-Man facing off against the Vulture, right, and he's, like, about to take down this plane, and it could hurt people, and in this movie, it's just like, yeah, no, none of that.
Yeah, it's just the eight people in this movie are involved, and that's it.
Exactly, yeah, I think it was Peyton Reed who described it this way. It might have been somebody else, but I think it was Peyton Reed who described it as an Elmore Leonard story, where it's just like several different parties going after the same MacGuffin, and the drama coming from that. And
yeah.
I think that's a pretty apt description. I think it's kind of cool. But yeah, and Paul Rudd is just, I think he's just the kind of actor who can make me laugh in just about anything. Like he's part of some of my favorite comedies, and he brings that goofy charm again as Scott Lang. And Evangeline Lilly gets like a more substantial role in this movie than she did in the first one, and that's great. She gets to be a badass, which is super satisfying, because that was one of the most frustrating things about the first one, is that they kept teasing the idea that, you know, Evangeline Lilly would put on the costume and kick some ass as the Wasp. But they never did, right? And that was like the post-credit scene. It was like, yeah, it's about damn time. And I was like, I wish I could have seen that like in the climax of this movie or something, you know?
I do really appreciate that she just like totally outclasses Lang. Like just in every turn, she's better at the thing.
Yes, yeah. And that feels very much in character with both those characters. Like Scott Lang is just like the goofy dude who's kind of bumbling through this entire ordeal. Right?
Yeah.
And she's the one who's trained her entire life to be the Wasp. So it makes sense that she would be really good at it. Also, Walton Goggins is in this movie, and that's awesome. He brings the Goggins, and it's glorious.
The Goggins is on 11.
Yeah, that's pretty great. And Michael Peña deserves an Oscar for this movie, I think.
I'm still waiting for the like Marvel short. That's just Luis recapping from Iron Man 1 until whatever movie they decide to do it before.
Yeah. I read they actually did something similar to that at some point. I think it was like for a Comic-Con thing. Maybe it was last year, like when they were announcing Ant-Man and the Wasp or something, or when they were announcing the villain or something, whatever. But at Comic-Con, they did a promotional video where it's Paul Rudd and Michael Peña recapping every Marvel movie up to that point.
Oh, my God.
And for some reason, they've never released that video. I think they should. It would be awesome. But anyway, yeah, so he's great in the movie. Also, Michelle Pfeiffer's in this, and I would say not nearly enough Michelle Pfeiffer is in this. I think she's really just there in the beginning and the end. And, you know, it feels like a role to me where it's like, she'll be in other movies, we promise. But we can only get her for, like, 3 days on this one, so we got to make them count kind of thing.
Yeah, and it feels real weird that the Ant-Man movies seem to be the like the de-aging showcase, because we had the first one was the young Michael Douglas, which I think might have been the first time we saw that.
I believe it was, yeah.
And then we saw young Robert Downey Jr. in Civil War, I think.
Yeah, and then young Kurt Russell in Guardians 2.
Right, and then now we get young Michael Douglas, young Michelle Pfeiffer, young Lawrence Fishburne. Like, we're just, everybody's young. It's the 70s again. Like, everybody's cool and hot.
Yeah, and that de-aging tech is... It really blows my mind. Like, it blew my mind in Ant-Man when it was that good. And, like, it feels like it's just gotten better over time. And I think what makes it work as compared to, like, you know, Grand Moff Tintin in Rogue One was that...
Grand Moff Tintin?
You're welcome.
That mental image is amazing.
But, yeah, you know, there's that CGI Grand Moff Tarkin, right? And, you know, I feel like... What makes this work compared to that is that you actually have the actor physically there, just, you know, actually performing their role. So you can just CGI, like, mess with their face, do CGI things and stuff, and, like, make them seem younger. But they have, like, the mannerisms and stuff that they would have normally because they're actually there performing the role. Whereas, like, with Grand Moff Tarkin, it's an entirely CGI creation. And there is, like, a stand-in actor doing things, but it's not Peter Cushing. So it's different than, you know, what it would be. So I think the de-aging tech that Marvel's been doing is... like, pretty stellar. And, like, I think they're going to use it again pretty prominently in Captain Marvel, because Samuel L. Jackson is in that movie as Nick Fury, and Phil Coulson's in it as Clark Gregg, and it takes place in the 90s. So they're going to have to de-age those guys by, like, you know, 20, 30 years. So I think... And presumably they're going to be in more of the movie, like, bigger than, like, cameo roles. So I think that could be... I feel like that could be, like, the big litmus test for, like, if this technology could, like, support, like, a whole movie.
That's some, like, Uncanny Valley shit.
It is. It's super weird. There was a movie called The Congress a couple years ago, which starred Robin Wright, which was basically about that, where she played an actor who, like, submitted her consciousness to, like, a machine that could, like, CGI their performance into a movie.
Whoa.
That's happening. It's real. That movie just came out 3 years ago, and it's already, like... it's already happening. But anyway, I also really like how this movie has relatively little action going on up into the climax. Like, I feel like for a long stretch, like, there's no action scenes, right? It's just like, you know, like, they're kind of accomplishing goals and stuff throughout the movie, but, like, there's no real action. I mean, there's, like, the opening scene with the Wasp, the first time you see the Wasp in action, and then up until like the big, like, car chase moment, which is awesome, there's not really a ton of action in the movie. And I don't know, I feel like it kind of contributes to the laid-back vibe that this movie's going for.
Yeah, it makes sense to me. It does feel, for a long stretch, like we're just kind of on a romp with Ant-Man and just Paul Rudd, basically. Which, like, I'm down. I want to hang out with Paul Rudd. Who doesn't want to do that?
Right, definitely.
Colin, anything?
I think Mike covered, one of these mics covered it all.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, for the most part, I think, I mean, how did you feel this movie compared tonally to something like Infinity War, right? I feel like this is a relatively lightweight movie, and the stakes are small. I think they work, but I mean, I feel like every movie for a while now has had, like, a much more epic scope, like with Infinity War, even, like, the cultural phenomenon that Black Panther was, Thor Ragnarok, and Guardians. I feel like this has more of a Spider-Man Homecoming vibe, except it's even smaller than that, you know, since there are no cameos from any other Marvel characters, whereas Homecoming, you're just, like, shoving Avengers in there left and right, like, you know?
Yeah,
I think, like, one of the big differences for me is all those other movies, like, I'm sitting on the edge of my seat, like, waiting for the next thing to happen, and this one was definitely just, like, hanging out with a friend at the movie theater, just like, oh, yeah. this is some shit, this is awesome.
Right, yeah, I never felt like I was, like, you know, enraptured by the story and I needed to know what happened next, but I was just, like, enjoying, like, a rollicking good time with, you know, Paul Rudd and Evangeline Lilly. And, like, that's pretty cool. And the ensemble they got is fun, and the shrinking effects are really cool. It's just a good time. It's a good time all around, guys.
Yeah. I will say it does feel nice to have a movie that is not explicitly about the end of the world for the first time in a while in right. the Marvel Universe.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like Ragnarok, literally, the end of the world. Black Panther, I guess not so much, but, you know, like in a philosophical sense.
Sure. I mean, is that the end of a nation? The end of a culture? Right.
End of a culture. And then Infinity War is just Infinity War. And here we are. Just got to get this lab back, guys. I got to get that thing.
I do want a shrinking car.
Yeah.
Yes, 100%.
Car chases with shrinking cars, though. That was awesome.
Yeah. Now, do you think those were actual cars that they shrunk down, or were they Hot Wheel cars that they modified to be able to drive?
Holy shit.
Whoa. Hashtag deep.
Because I was thinking about that, and I was like, if those are Hot Wheels, like, I feel like I can do that.
Like, if I can make an engine that small.
Yeah, I can make an engine that small and make it go, and that can grow the car. It'll be fine.
Yeah.
I just got to develop the technology. It's there. It could exist. But yeah, otherwise, any overall thoughts left, or should we move on to spoilers?
Let's move on to spoilers, I think.
Okay, let's do that. I think there is some spoiler stuff to get into, so let's do that. Let's move on to spoilers for Ant-Man and the Wasp, starting right now.
Stop it! Both of you! You're spoiling everything!
All right, spoilers for Ant-Man and the Wasp, starting right now. So I feel like this movie doesn't have a ton of things that can actually be spoiled. Like, okay, so they get Michelle Pfeiffer back from the Quantum Realm. And all that, but should we talk about the post credits first and then move on into some other stuff so we can talk about the actual universe affecting things?
Sure.
All right. So there are two post credit scenes in the movie. The first one is the really important one, which is that Scott goes back to the quantum realm to retrieve something like some healing particles or whatever for Ghost, and then he gets stuck in the quantum realm after the Thanos snap happens, which makes Hank, Janet, and Hope all disappear. How was your reaction to that scene, guys? Because I was, like, I was distraught a little bit. I'm glad they saved it for the post credits. Because my fear, like, while I was watching the movie, Mike, you were saying that, like, you were distracted by the weight of Infinity War, mm-hmm. and I sort of felt the same way because towards the end of the movie, I was like, as soon as Janet Van Dyne comes out of that quantum realm, she's going to disappear again. Because of the Thanos snap, and my stomach was like hurting because of it. I was like, "This is gonna suck." Oh my god! But then they saved it for the post credits, and I think that was a lot better because it doesn't affect the actual movie that was made, right? It doesn't have to.
Yeah.
I feel like it would have messed up the tone of the movie if like you had this like really fun Ant-Man adventure that ended on this really fucking dark note,
and then his daughter crumbles to dust in his arms.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So by saving it for the post credits, you have this like scene that's like. I feel like it still sort of hurts a little bit that those three characters disappeared. But also, it's kind of played as a joke, and you kind of take it as one. There's more like a winking nod to Infinity War, which I liked. And the fact that Scott is stuck in the quantum realm is you know, an interesting wrinkle into what will happen to Avengers 4. And I'm curious how you guys reacted to it, and also how your audience reacted to that scene. Because my audience reaction was fantastic.
So half of my audience left before... the most powerful.
Oh, really? Bunch of scrubs.
Man.
So there with my friend, and like just 20 people got up and left. I was like, you do not know. Like, what happens after this?
We've done 20 of these already.
Exactly. Right. But, you know, as Mike was saying, you know, during the entire movie, you kind of have Infinity War in the back of your mind. But, you know, at the end of the movie, I was like, just, you know, I was really happy with how everything worked out. I was like, kind of calm and relaxed. And then that happened. I was like, oh shit, right. Like, this is part of something bigger. And yeah. So I was like, kind of jaw dropped. I was like, oh, this is not good. No. So it's kind of like a snap back to reality of like what's going right on in this universe.
A literal snap back to reality.
Hey.
I nice. Pretend I was clever enough to make that reference.
Yeah, how did you react, Mike? What was your take on that scene?
Yeah, I thought I expected it to happen earlier in the scene. I didn't think he was going to go into the I thought he was going to be standing at the in front of the gateway to the quantum realm and like turn around and they'd be gone or something like that.
Right.
So he goes to the quantum realm and then I'm like, "Oh, wait, what? Is he going to disappear from the quantum realm? Like what's going to happen?
This
That's
is going to be so too, yeah.
This is going to be so weird." And then we come back and when they cut to that shot of the three dust clouds like blowing away or whatever. The people that were left were all like, oh, like it was like a whole yeah. crazy, like gut reaction that we all had,
right.
Which was awesome. That was a cool experience.
Yeah.
And I'm scared for Scott, guys. So I won't lie.
Yeah. No,
what's he going to do?
I mean, I'm sure
he'll question mark of they will return question mark. I'm like,
yeah, I really like that too.
That was great. That was great. But yeah, no, my audience had like, this kind of groan that happened when they saw the three dust clouds. Like it was like it cuts back to the outside, and you see the dust billowing away, and my entire audience was like, "Oh, come on!" And like it was pretty great. But yeah, then there was the second post credit scene where it's just an ant playing drums. While the TV is playing like an emergency broadcast, so it seems like the snap has already happened in this in mm-hmm. scene too. And the house is empty other than the ant, so I don't know if that like means like. The family's gone too. If like Judy Greer and Bobby Cannavale and the daughter are like out as well, or if because I don't know if they were living in the house or not, or were they? I don't
think
remember.
So.
The ant was there. The ant survived. So that's
the ant's
it.
There.
The ant made it. And then yeah, and the scene ends and you see Ant-Man and the Wasp will return? Question mark. And that was fantastic. I love that they've been like messing around with that at the end of the movies. Like because after Infinity War, it was like Thanos will return, and it's like God damn it.
Yeah. Yeah, I do want to shout out to this isn't like it shouldn't have to be in the spoiler section, I guess. But I just really love how like progressive and supportive Bobby Cannavale's character's
yes.
relationship with Scott Langit, like with
yeah.
Paul Rudd. I don't remember that from the first one because I thought the first one was sort of like them butting heads, right? Like the new
right.
stepfather kind of
well,
thing.
Yeah, I mean he was the new stepfather, and also he was like the cop that was tasked with like bringing
right.
Scott Lang in, kind of thing.
And then it ended with them all having like a family dinner together, right?
Right, because they say because Scott saved Cassie and he went to the quantum realm and all that. But yeah, Bobby Cannavale and Judy Greer are in this movie for maybe 2 minutes, like max. But I think they make a lot of good use of it at a time. I think Bobby Cannavale in particular is really funny. Like he hugs Scott a lot. That's like a big thing.
All
he's
the
like
time,
hugging, and it's great. Also, Judy Greer has like one really funny line where she makes fun of the FBI, and it's like, what? It was the always like fucking always bothering people or something. Like I don't know what it was. I don't remember what it was. But she like seems so proud of it, and like everyone was like, all right.
Yeah. She's like making like these accusations. They're not allowed to do what they're doing. He's just
right.
like, oh, they're allowed to do this.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
can
yeah.
be here.
Yeah. No, they don't need a warrant.
But yeah, I mean, they're in the movie for like less than 2 minutes, but they make a decent amount of screen. Like they make the most of that 2 minutes when they're there. And Cassie is great. I love Cassie in this movie. Abby Ryder Fortson. Like I'm usually I'm pretty ambivalent about most child actors. But I think she does very well in these Ant-Man movies. And I know in the comics, I know Cassie eventually grows up to be an Ant-Man herself, whatever, I forget exactly what they call her, but she does get like a shrinking suit and stuff like that. So I think if they keep making these movies, who knows how long those will be, you know, that could be a thing that could happen. I mean, they sort of hinted that, in the movie actually, when she says like, maybe you should get a partner and I meant me and that
yeah.
kind of thing, which was the cutest conversation of all time. Anyway. Yeah. So let's talk about some of the actual stuff in the movie. Like some of the actual things that happened, some terrific sight gags going on in the movie with the shrinking and growing stuff. I think my favorite had to be Scott's malfunctioning suit. which was a great running gag throughout the movie, which resulted in Little Kid Ant-Man, which was...
which was so great. Weird.
That was adorable. Like, that was pretty fantastic. And they put, like, the sweatshirt on him, and he's, like, the arms are flapping in the... flapping as he runs. It was pretty great. I also really liked Big Scott in Little Room.
Little Kid Ant-Man seemed like something you would see at 2 in the morning on, like, Adult Swim. Just like...
Hey, speaking of, Tim Heidecker is in this movie.
From Tim and Eric?
Yeah, he played the boat captain.
Oh my god. I thought he looked familiar. Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
I love that bit in the school, especially when the teacher's like, hey, you know, stop, and he just keeps running away, and the teacher's like, yeah. And I was like, that just unfortunately feels like every teacher I know. like they know they have a job, they just don't care enough.
Yep. Yeah, pretty much. Also, when the Tim Heidecker scene shows up, when Giant Man is being mistaken for a whale, that was also pretty great. He has the whale tail, but it's like his legs like spreading outward.
I really liked the shrinking or size changing stuff that we use it differently in this one. Like, it's a pretty interesting progression of those abilities. You know, when the Wasp is in her big first action scene in the kitchen and she, you know, enlarges the salt shaker and, like, uses that kind of ability to affect objects instead of just her changing size. Like, because we didn't really see a ton of that, I don't remember.
There's definitely some of that in the first Ant-Man. Like, there's the part when they grow the tank that was on Hank's keychain and stuff like that. There's also, I mean, they grow the ant to big size and... that kind of thing. I think there's something else that they shrink or grow that was like kind of a big thing. But yeah, no, there's a lot more of that in this movie.
Yeah, and like you talked about before, the car chase using the shrinking and expanding car to flip other cars over and stuff is awesome.
I love that sequence because, I mean, you know, we've seen car chases in movies a lot. And I think that Peyton Reed kind of looks at this movie and is like, all right, so what would a car chase look like if you could shrink cars? And, and it's pretty cool, and it's, you know, kind of recall it, like, has a lot of film techniques that recall other car chases. I mean, it takes place in San Francisco, right. Kind of has like the kind of like classic like bullet kind of car chase thing going on, but it, you know, it's messing around with different sizes of cars and different things, and it's pretty cool. Also, I mean, just the ghost in the movie, I think, was a really cool visual idea, like the way she kind of like fades in and out of things, and that's her power. I mean, I liked her as a villain because she's not really a villain in a weird sense. This movie doesn't really have a villain other than maybe Walton Goggins, who is just like a low-level criminal guy. But, Ghost's motivations in this movie, like, aren't out of evil. They're just, like, self-preservation, right? So, like, as a result, I think this movie feels very different than most Marvel movies, where even, like, the villains who are more sympathetic... like, you know, Killmonger in Black Panther or something, which is the movie that Colin hasn't seen, but Killmonger's very good.
Yes.
You know, even those villains, like, are still doing bad guy things. And Ghost is, you know, fighting our heroes, and that's a bad guy thing, sure. But at the same time, like, she's not really, like, hurting anybody else. I mean, she is, but...
but like you said, it's purely out of a need to survive.
Yeah,
right? It's
desperation.
Not like...
Yeah, and I also like that she gets her powers from, like, trying to do something good. Like, she, like, ran back to her dad, like, when he was in trouble.
Right.
Yeah. Like, she was, like, actively trying to help somebody and just got completely screwed over by it.
Yeah, definitely. So I think I think there's a lot more to be explored with that character. So I think there's a lot of cool directions that could take. So hopefully she shows up again. I think she probably will, because it's a Marvel movie, so they usually show up again.
Yeah, and I think the post-credits scene, right, that they were going to get healing unobtainium, basically, whatever. It's like the stupidest name for a thing. Healing particles or whatever for Ghost in that scene. So I think she'll come back eventually.
Yeah, definitely. Although that was also one of my concerns, was that, like, you know, because her whole thing was that she didn't want to disappear, right?
Oh, no.
And my concern was that at the end of the movie, like, the Thanos snap would happen, like, after they had gotten her like, life back, and then she would disappear. And I was like, that would be such a cruelly ironic twist. And they didn't go for that. But, like, that we know of. Yeah, you're right. But, yeah, otherwise, Randall Park, very funny in this movie.
Yeah.
Also enjoyed him quite a lot. He's the FBI agent who is tasked with keeping Scott home during his house arrest.
Wants to go on a date with him.
Yeah. Really, I really enjoyed that. I love the way he was just trying to learn magic. after being impressed by Scott doing magic. And actually, that whole scene at the beginning, actually, I really love that opening sequence with the cardboard maze. And like the cardboard, you can tell Scott had a lot of time on his hands to make that maze, but it also felt like it felt like something straight out of like an 80s family comedy, like the kind of like breakfast machine type thing that you would see in Pee Wee's Big Adventure or something like that. Like that's sort of what that felt like to me.
Yeah.
So I dug that about it, definitely.
Most of what he did while under house arrest just felt like something like our friends would do in college while drunk.
Listen, man.
That sounds about right. That sounds about right. But yeah, I also really like how this movie does follow up Civil War and deal with the fallout of that. And I think it's interesting that Civil War has become like this linchpin Marvel film because its effects are felt in, I think, 4 movies now. Because you have Homecoming, which deals right after Civil War. Black Panther, which deals with the immediate aftermath of his father's death in Civil War. Obviously Infinity War, where the Avengers are split up. And now this. So I think it's interesting that like that has become the movie almost. Like if you don't see Civil War, you're going to miss out on certain plot elements from various movies all across the Marvel Universe.
This is a bad time to tell you I also haven't seen Civil War.
Wait, for real?
No, I'm kidding.
Okay. Oh my god.
I was going to boot you from the podcast, I think.
Just delete your recording, it's fine.
That would actually be great if I deleted your recording, but I kept in me and Mike, so it was just like, and what do you think, Colin? And then there's just silence for 30 seconds. But, yeah, I do kind of wish there was, I mean, I said before that I do like the fact that there's a very little action in this movie, and it's more just like, it's fun hangout adventure. Part of me does wish there was a little more action scenes, just because the Wasp and Ghost have powers that looked really cool visually and could have been explored more. But at the same time, this movie feels very laid back, and I kind of like that about it. So, you know, it's like I feel like breaking that up with more action just for the sake of more action might have messed with that. So I'm okay with that. Also, I wanted to talk about Louise's story under the Truth Serum.
Oh, my God.
It's a showstopper. That's yeah. Michael Peña's Oscar clip right there. That's... It's amazing. I mean, so in the first movie, the Louise stories were, like, the best part of the movie. I think that happened twice in the first movie. It only happens once in this one, which is a disappointment. But when it does happen, it's, like, halfway through the movie, and it's fantastic. And also, the running Truth Serum gag is also especially really great. And the way that pays off at the end, where the guy the guy who invented it has it injected into him, and it's like, oh, my God, it is Truth Serum. It's very good.
There's a lot of running gags in this movie, and they're all great.
Yes, yeah. Also a big fan of the Baba Yaga running gag.
Yeah.
Which, when that first came up, and, like, David S. Malchum was like, Baba Yaga, I was like, oh my god, is this going to be a John Wick crossover? Is John Wick going to show up in an Ant-Man movie? Because I'll freak the fuck out. And that didn't happen. But man.
But imagine.
But I wish. But yeah, I mean, what did you guys think of the Quantum Realm and all the stuff that happened in the Quantum Realm? Getting Michelle Pfeiffer back and all that stuff.
I definitely thought they were going to run out of time at a certain point. They were like, we have a 2-hour time span that all this shit happens. And I was like, dude, has this not been 2 hours yet? Like, for them to get to her? And then she just, like, you know, they get there and she's just like, hey, I figured this all out. Like, we can get out of here. So it was like the little bit of tension I think the movie needed, just like right. In the back of your head, just like, are they actually gonna mess this up? I feel like another century before the things would line up for them to find her again.
Right, something like that.
So it was like that little bit of tension that you needed to be like, okay, they actually do have to do something here. It's not just, we're not just like having fun with Ant-Man and the Wasp, like they have an actual goal here.
Right, definitely. Mike, what did you think? I mean, how about on a visual level, did you think the Quantum Realm compared to how it was in the first movie? Because the first movie, I feel like, had this very cool, very trippy 2001 A Space Odyssey style, like, segue into the Quantum Realm. And I feel like this one doesn't go as far into that, but I think it was still a very cool visual.
Yeah, I think it has this weird, like sound wave or like audio recording look thing. I don't know how to describe it exactly, but, you know, everything's sort of like oscillating. And it is super weird. It looks, you know, fractally and weird. But I think it's sort of interesting that post Doctor Strange, where we have a lot of dimension hopping.
Yeah.
This sort of thing, it almost comes off as like natural and expected and normal. And I don't mean boring. I just mean like,
right.
Yeah, of course shit looks like this. And it's not, and the movie doesn't try to play it as spectacle, which it did in the first one, I think. The first Ant-Man. So it's a interesting progression in just the cinematic universe as a whole, where like this kind of shit can happen and it's not the weirdest thing that's ever happened.
Right. Yeah, definitely. And also there's big blobby bugs. So there's that too.
Who doesn't like tardigrades?
Also, there's a scene in the movie where Paul Rudd channels Michelle Pfeiffer, and that's really good. That's a really funny scene. I think what makes that scene even funnier is that it's played completely straight. Like, it's a very emotional moment for Hope and Hank. And so, when, like, there's like, oh my god, and it's like it's beautiful moment, like they're seeing each other for the first time in 30 years, but it's Paul Rudd and not Michelle Pfeiffer. So that was really funny.
I really love that they didn't go for the, like, obvious, like, oh, it's a woman in a man's body joke. Like, it doesn't do that at all. It just has, like, right. the weird, like, oh, we're holding hands gag at the end.
he does look longingly into his eyes for a minute.
Yeah, but I mean, like, that's what I mean. Like, it plays it earnestly. It's not a joke that it's a woman in a man's body kind of thing. Right. Which is
but
awesome.
But that's why it's funny, is because it's so earnest, I feel like. That's pretty great.
It does a better version of the shitty joke.
All right. Are there any other things you want to talk about in the movie, guys? Any scenes that stood out to you? I feel like this doesn't have as much stuff going on as other Marvel movies, but I think it's also by design. You know, I feel like there's maybe not as much to discuss, but it's just a very enjoyable, pleasant experience.
I did like the whole business that the ex-cons had put together as like a security company. You know, after spending an entire movie trying to rob someone, they're like, well, if we can do it that way, we can do the opposite of it.
Right.
And, you know, Michael Bane's character just, like, you know, hiding the fact that they're about to go out of business by cutting all costs and freaking out about pastries. Like, the little intimate pastries. Like, what is this?
That was pretty great. I also love they called the business ex-con. I just thought that was a very funny joke. But, Mike, what were you going to say?
I just want to say, hashtag give Louise a suit. That's all.
That is all. I mean, he gets to do some shrinking in this movie, in the car. So I think, yeah, he might as well just get a suit. Why not?
Suits for everybody.
Suits for everybody. Just make a whole ant team. I would be into that, actually, if it's like Ant-Man and the Wasp and Louise. And that's the third movie. I'm so in for that.
Yep. And the fourth one's Cassie.
And Cassie. Yeah. By that point, she'll be old enough where it would make sense. Yes.
Yeah.
Ant-Man and the Wasp. They just keep adding. And
yes.
So that is Ant-Man and the Wasp. I feel like we've pretty much got it all out there. It's a fun time. It's enjoyable. It's weird. Because I feel like, you know, we just saw Solo a few weeks back. Or I guess it was like almost 2 months ago at this point. And I feel like... Time makes no sense.
But it's a circle, man. It's fine.
It's a circle. We saw Solo a few weeks back, and we both kind of came down on Solo a lot, you know?
Yeah.
And I feel like it's weird, because I had, like, a reasonably fun time with Solo, and I had a reasonably fun time with Ant-Man and the Wasp. Like, I feel like I had a similar reasonably fun time with both movies, but I feel like I want to praise Ant-Man and the Wasp more, you know? I feel like there's less dumb stuff in Ant-Man and the Wasp than there is in Solo, even though Solo has, like, I think, you know, very solid action scenes and, like, fun performances and stuff. I don't know. Compared to this movie, it's, like, it's weird, because I feel like they're both, on a quality level, roughly the same, but Ant-Man and the Wasp is better, in a weird sense. Does that make sense? No?
I don't know. I didn't care about the story in Solo, because I knew how it ended already. So, like,
right. That's also
I cared
about
what was happening here.
Yeah. I think Solo, just like we talked about, it is just so obviously a cash grab kind of thing, or has that feel of just obviously someone wanted to get your $15, whatever it costs to go see a movie by you. And Ant-Man obviously is the same thing, but like fun and cool and interesting. And I don't know. It's just Solo just felt like I just you know?
Yeah, I didn't mean to reopen that old wound, but that's just... But anyway,
now,
yeah.
I'm just picturing scenes where someone else gives Indiana Jones the name Indiana, and I'm so mad.
Well, that wouldn't make any sense, because we already know where he got the name Indiana. Because they named the dog Indiana. That was the thing in Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. That's the line. They named the dog Indiana.
That was to test you in your Indiana Jones lore, because I definitely knew that.
No, what would happen is if we find out where the dog got the name Indiana. That's going to be the thing. The first flashback of Indiana Jones 5 mm-hmm. is going to have de-aged 5-year-old Alden Ehrenreich. And the dog comes home. And the dog comes home for the first time, and it's like, and, you know, D.H. Sean Connery is like, oh, wow, what should we name the dog? And the wife is like, how about Indiana? And that's the movie.
And then cut fade to credit, fade to title sequence.
yeah, so we'll find out how the dog is named Indiana, and it'll be great. It'll be powerful. Mm-hmm. But I think that about wraps up our thoughts on Ant-Man and the Wasp. we named the dog Ant-Man. All right, so guys, where can we find you online this week? Colin, do you have anything you want to plug, or is that are you just here for funsies?
Well, I have zero online presence, but I will be streaming some Magic the Gathering drafts with my coworker and boss, Dave Dame, at twitch.com/DCMDame okay. sometime this upcoming week. So if anyone out there likes Magic, come watch us make fools of ourselves.
Cool. All right, perfect. Mike, where can we find you online?
You can find me at MDFilmBlog on Twitter.
And you can find me at M. Smith Film Blog on Twitter, as well as our podcast stuff at filmbook.com. I host a couple of radio shows on WPDH and WRRV. And you can follow me on Instagram at Radio Mike Sandwich. Thank you so much for listening to Film Bookcast. I'm Mike Smith. That's Mike DeCrescio. And that is Colin Stiles. If you're listening to this review of our podcast on iTunes, subscribe to the podcast, rate it, take a moment to give us a review. Any and all feedback, compliments, topic discussions, and even hate mail can be sent directly to podcast@filmbook.com. Please list the podcast you're emailing about in the title of your email. We produce just so many different ones hard to keep track. We would love to hear from you. Now, join us for the next episode of Film Bookcast, where I think our mission, should we choose to accept it, will be to review Mission Impossible Fallout. Mike, you excited for this?
God fucking damn.
Oh my god.
It's finally happening.
Do you know how many times I've watched that fucking trailer? It's better than half the movies I've seen this year. That trailer alone. It's a trailer that's so good, it made me like an Imagine Dragons song, and that's...
yeah.
It's almost unforgivable. Anyway, yeah, so very excited about that. I actually just rewatched the first Mission Impossible today. I'm starting off my rewatch of the series, and holds up. I mean, I know you rewatched all of them a couple weeks back, and we talked about it on the podcast. But yeah, first Mission Impossible, very good movie, really good. The 90s hacking is hilarious, by the way, in that movie.
It is.
The way they envisioned the internet, where it's like, I'm going to send an email, and it's like these big blocky letters, and like he's typing out. It's pretty great. It's pretty great. But anyway, and you can check out our next Complete Works, where we're talking Nicolas Cage's role in 2011's Trespass. So, yeah.
Can't believe we're still only in 2011.
We're almost there, man. Yeah. I mean, it's 2018 now, so we only got 7 years to go and roughly 75 more movies. Right? That's
roughly more than half of the movies.
Exactly. So, looking forward to that. So, thanks for joining us, Colin. This is a lot of fun.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
What was that?
Good, thanks for having me.
I thought you said you found... I thought you said you found me. I was like, what? You weren't missing. You weren't Janet Van Dyne. In the quantum realm all these years. All right. thanks so much for listening, guys. We are out.
Damn. I fucked my aunt. And I fucked my aunt. Man. We fucked our aunts.
Yeah.
We fucked our aunts, y'all.
Oh, I can't believe it. They fucked their aunts. I mean, I fucked my aunt, too. Watch out, I'm Tim and making songs about it. Although we